Good morning, Santa Fe. Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the Affordable Housing Initiative, also known as the transfer tax. Right now, I'd like to welcome Stephen Mitchell. He's a scholar and translator. His new book is The Second Book of the Tao, and he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books tonight at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's good to be here.
Now, the first book of the Tao is Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, which you've published a version of. What is the second book?
The second book of the Tao is a companion volume to the Tao Te Ching. For those of you who know and love the Tao Te Ching, it's written in the same style of great clarity and depth by someone, as actually two ancient Chinese philosophers who lived this way, who lived in harmony always with the way things are. So it's a collection that I've anthologized from two ancient anthologies. Some people might know the name Shuang Tzu, who was the great disciple of Lao Tzu. And the other old Chinese dude is Tzu Tzu, who was Confucius's grandson. And they both have marvelous material just filled with insight and wit and great profundity, but it's buried in a mass of other kinds of material, either written by them on days when they had a bellyache or written by other people. Nobody knows who wrote what quite, but there are hundreds of pages of this material, and I've kind of unburied the best of the best, and that's what the second book of the Tao is.
So you chose 64 pieces, and there are translations of them, or adaptations of them, as you call them. What is an adaptation opposed to a translation?
Well, I've done both. I've translated things from both ancient texts and 20th century poetry, and I know quite a few languages, ancient Hebrew, German, I know Greek, I'm working on Homer now, and there are languages that I don't know but that I feel a great affinity towards in terms of my own upbringing as an adult with my intensive Zen training, studying with Zen masters, etc. So when I first began to work with the Tao Te Ching, I wouldn't have dared do that if I hadn't felt that the translations that existed at that time, and somebody counted them up, there were 103 into English alone by the time I got to mine. I felt that they had been done by linguists and theologians and academic scholars, and that nobody had really come from the place in translating Lao Tzu that met him at the place of insight. And there are lots of little things that I knew intuitively had got to be off. And so I plunged into it and worked with dozens of versions into English, French, and German. And with my experience at translating, I felt that I could educate myself enough to do a responsible job. And in the end, I had a version that I liked very much and that a huge public found that they liked very much as well.
So what you brought to it, among other things, is that you were a Zen practitioner.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. I had decades of years of that, of doing nothing but that under my belt. And the Zen tradition is really, the two streams that run into that are Buddhism and the ancient Taoism of Shuang Tzu and Lao Tzu. The later Taoism becomes pretty calcified and obsessed with very, at best, secondary issues like immortality and all sorts of silly kinds of magic. But the older spirit of the Tao as embodied in Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu is the most lighthearted thing in the world and only concerned with essence and how we are to position ourselves so that we can be in the flow of reality always.
Let's talk about some of the pieces. There are 64 pieces, which is a nod at the I Ching, as you say in the introduction, as well as the Beatles. but you write, well, first of all, you write that Chuang Tzu is a person who freed himself from his own beliefs. What does it mean to free yourself from your own beliefs?
Well, that's a good question. Anybody that investigates the mind to any depth understands quite quickly that all human suffering is caused by believing our own untrue thoughts. It's not possible to suffer unless you're believing a stressful thought. And so there are various methods to deal with this basic human delusion. There are wonderfully powerful methods of meditation to train you in stillness and so that you can really look at the thoughts that are flitting through your mind and step aside. There's also a long tradition of self-inquiry. The most powerful, by far, the most powerful modern version of that is called The Work, and it was discovered by my wife, actually. My wife's name is Byron Katie, and people interested in self-inquiry would do well to visit her website, thework.com. But in any case, the bottom line is that when you're able to clearly see the thoughts that are causing your unhappiness and write them down and question them, then that questioning allows the thought to unravel by itself. You can't let go of a thought because you didn't create it in the first place, and that's an endeavor that's doomed to failure. But the thought can let go of you when it's seen into thoroughly enough, and that, in fact, is what always happens with anybody sincerely seeking the truth and questioning his or her own mind.
What's the difference between the kind of truth that you're talking about and, for example, scientific truth, in which you come across the fact that, you know, hydrogen has one proton and so on, and helium has two, whatever, and you use those things, which are truths, to actually do things. Those are thoughts, they're beliefs, they're metaphors, but they're quite useful.
They are indeed, and what I'm talking about here is stressful thoughts that cause, where there's a cause and effect of stress. For instance, I'm too fat, or I'm not good enough, or my mother didn't love me enough, or life is unfair, or people shouldn't be dying in Darfur, or we should be spending more money on AIDS research, or I don't have enough money. Any thought like that, ranging from the extremely petty and trivial and personal to the grandly altruistic and humanitarian, can cause inner devastation. And when you're aware that a thought is having that kind of effect on you, that's the time to take a good look at it through this kind of questioning that's available through the work. The thought, the sky is blue, does not cause stress or water is H2O. It can, I suppose, in certain odd kinds of minds, and then it would be something that one would want to put up against inquiry. But usually that kind of thought just blithely goes through us without having any kind of negative effect.
In the commentary that you write on the very first piece in the book, you write, "We're born into the open, into the vast mind of empty of meaning, beyond thought, beyond things, reality just is." What does the word mind mean in this context? We normally think of the mind as human or animal, and that's something that has thoughts, that's not empty.
Yes, that's right. That's quite a small way of looking at mind. The Buddhists have a much larger way of looking at mind, and when you actually see deeply into mind, you see that there aren't any boundaries at all. That all boundaries are boundaries that are created by specific thoughts. So when you are not believing your thoughts and are free of them, you find a sense of vastness where everything that was obvious before may not be so obvious now. Even the question of what it is to be human or alive, the distinction between life and death. I mean, all sorts of things that we take for granted and are taught as very young children are ways of breaking up the world into categories and really separating the world. And when we're very young children, with the vibrancy and the incredible openness and curiosity that a very young child has, we don't see the world through these concepts that were later taught, and it results in tremendous joy and creativity and happiness. So there's a way of unlearning what we, most of us, very solemnly believe how the world is, and breaking through into something much more vast and open.
It's funny that you say that in childhood, before you name and categorize everything, there's so much joy and creativity. I remember actually very distinctly the experience of being so frustrated because I didn't have the words to say things, and the tremendous joy in actually learning words so that I could articulate what I was thinking inside. It seems like it's almost the opposite of what you're saying.
Well, I can appreciate that experience too, but if you step back into you before there were any words to even look for, before you had no idea what a word was, that's a very different experience. When you were at your mother's breast, for example, or just lying happily gurgling in the crib, there's an intimacy there that we lose later in life and that can be regained. It's when we first start to see the world through the separation that words make that stress begins to happen. And this is not something that I'm saying. It's something that has been recognized by the clearest minds in our human heritage, such as the Buddha and Lao Tzu. They're all starting from that basic insight. And it's extremely helpful to have this perspective on mind, what goes on in the mind, how mind creates suffering, and how it can uncreate it as well. It's really what we're all wanting in the first place, and it's our birthright, the kind of happiness and peace that's possible in this process.
We're talking to author Stephen Mitchell. His book is The Second Book of the Tao. He'll be speaking at Garcia Street Books tonight at 5 o'clock. It seems to me that there's a lot of paradoxes in this work.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And it's sort of fun and interesting to sit with them because you can't resolve them easily. The first line in section number 3 is, "The great Tao cannot be named." Well, there's a paradox right there. You just named it. It cannot be known or understood. In that case, what are these books for?
Well, that's an excellent question. These books are pure love. They're pure kind-heartedness. Somebody like Chuang Tzu or Lao Tzu starts out with an absolute realization that whatever is valuable can't be said. And at the same time, I would say a joyous compulsion to say it, because if it's not said by somebody that clear, everything else that's said will be even more confusing. So it's that kind of what they call in Buddhism bodhisattva effort, doing something for the sake of all beings and not from a personal ego space, that really drives somebody like that to write write down truths that can't possibly be true, ultimately. But one of the remarkable and extremely attractive things about Chuang Tzu and Lao Tzu, and that I think runs throughout the second book of the Tao, is that they're using language with the realization that language can't touch it, that the Tao cannot be stated, expressed, explained, anything like that. And yet, when they speak with paradox, with wit, with these marvelous, lighthearted word games that have as much to do with what the silence that surrounds a word as with the word itself, you find that by reading what they've written, you're moving into a space beyond words. In other words, any time you're tempted to grasp a truth and say to yourself, that's it, that's what they meant, that's what I needed to know, in the next sentence it might be contradicted, or two sentences down, or you'll find that within three or four sentences there are seven different contradictory directions that the words are coming from, or in the space of a paragraph you'll find the rug pulled out from under you 12 times, and there's not, you look down at your feet and there's no ground there, and you may feel panicky or you may feel ecstatic, but the fact is that these words have helped you move into the place that my old Zen master used to call don't know mind, the mind that is free of its own concepts and therefore completely open.
Let's go back for a moment to the original context in which these pieces were written. What was that, and was there a relationship between these pieces and a meditation practice that was being taught?
Well, we don't know. It's a very good question. We don't know anything about these two old Chinese dudes that I've collected these passages from. Chuang Tzu, we know maybe three or four facts, his family name, where he was born. The old biographer says he may have been a librarian. And about Confucius's grandson, all we know is that he was the grandson of Confucius, and that's it. About the context, there's very little that we know. We know that the 300 or 400 pages of the Chuang Tzu that remain were edited by a later editor who lived 500 or 600 years after Chuang Tzu and cut the anthology down some, I think from 51 to 33 chapters, something like that. But basically, that's it. And it's obvious to scholars that the Chuang Tzu, for instance, is very heterogeneous. It's a grab bag. Some of it was written by Chuang Tzu himself. Nobody knows what. There's a lot of material that speaks with the greatest clarity and insight and an amazing, outrageous humor to it. Nothing else like it in all of literature. And yet there are story after story and passage after passage that's filled with dullness and silliness. So I've anthologized both of these anthologies and picked out the most brilliant and the funniest and the clearest of the clear. And all else that we have are more or less uninformed guesses.
I was wondering if you would like to read, or I can read aloud, one of them. It's the number 52. Shall I read it?
Sure, and then I could read the commentary if you like.
Okay.
As you wish.
Okay, well, let's start, because I have a question about it.
Sure.
The duck's legs are short. You cannot lengthen them without making her suffer. The crane's legs are long. You cannot shorten them without causing him pain. What is long needs no cutting off. What is short needs no stretching. When you realize this, you can let the world go its own way. Do you think that you know what's best? Do you think Do you think that the world should conform to your way of thinking? All these benevolent people, how much worrying they do. Since ancient times, what a lot of fuss and upheaval the benefactors of humanity have caused. And, you know, you write in your commentary that, as you say, even with the kindest of intentions, you can't try to change people without inflicting violence on them and yourself. And I'm sure that many of our listeners can think of examples where well-meaning people try to change other people to no effect. But then there's a question that it arises for me, for parents and teachers of young people. How do you discern what is just the way they are, and how do you discern what it is that needs to be overcome? You know, I mean, your kid is a lazy brat. You know, do you just, that's just the way they are. The duck's legs are short.
Well, you know, that's a huge question and a fascinating one. What parents who are seriously interested in the welfare of their children and have learned how to investigate their own minds might do would be to write down that sentence, Bobby is a lazy brat, and see if that's actually true. The questions that are available through the work, my wife's method of self-inquiry, are these. Is it true is the first one. Can I absolutely know that it's true is the second one. How do I react when I believe that thought is the third, and who would I be without it is the fourth. And then there's a turnaround that allows us to experience the opposite of that stressful thought. So, I mean, if you're interested, I could go through it quickly in a little bit of detail to show you what that might look like. But in any case, that judgment may be accurate, or it may be wildly inaccurate, and totally predicated on what my mother told me about me when I was a kid, or what their attitudes or their great-great-grandfathers who were maybe Calvinists in Minnesota, how they looked at the world, and it might have nothing to do with the best way that my little boy could develop. So, you know, a parent who approaches bringing up children with an open heart and a willingness to question what he thinks or she thinks is best is doing the child an amazing service and allowing the child to develop in his own way, and who knows what that will look like. Who are the great writers who dropped out of high school or college and then later found their way? You know, Shakespeare's father might have kept scolding him to stay in school and go to Oxford and not run away to this tawdry theater atmosphere in London, you know, thinking that he was just wanting the best for his child. How can we know?
And at the same time, for example, I have a friend who's a music teacher and has students who don't practice and takes rather strict measures and really gets them to practice. And it's not something that they would just do on their own by their own nature. They really have to be pushed into it, and often to very good results.
Well, that's wonderful. Obviously, he's found a way to support these children without alienating them, and that's a great talent, and all honor to him. Often when parents push a child into practicing music where their child doesn't have a desire or much of a gift either, it's not pretty, the kinds of tensions that build up between child and parent. And if my interest with a child would not be to have him develop into a musician or a doctor or anything else for that matter, but just to surround him with love and intelligence and be for him the example of somebody who is living my talk, who is living always in harmony with reality, and to trust him to find his own way. I think that's the best way of bringing up a child.
We're talking to Stephen Mitchell. His new book is called The Second Book of the Tao. There's also the question that arises if you are going to, for example, take the admonition in number 51, unchain yourself from achievement and enjoy an ordinary life. Flow like the Tao, unhindered, unnoticed, unnamed, with no goals and no expectations. Let's say that you are by nature an activist and you want to, for example, fight against the kind of racism that Martin Luther King was fighting against and so on. It seems like that's not very useful advice.
Well, it may seem that way, and for you it may not be useful in the least. However, for somebody else who is a passionate and committed activist, it may be the most useful thing she's ever heard. I know lots of activists, and one of the dangers of plunging into that kind of world is that you burn out, some of them very quickly and totally, and it takes a long time to regenerate. People who, with that passionate commitment, learn how to connect with the essence of themselves and to spend time, if not their whole lives, in a state of not knowing, where the mind is free, where creativity can move wherever it wants without any control or forcing from an intellect that thinks it knows best, find that this is the greatest enhancement to their activism, that rather than seeing other human beings as enemies, like the polluters, the business corporations, etc., rather than seeing them as the enemy, they're able to see them as fellow human beings who don't have a clue any more than the rest of us do and are only trying to do their best. And they find that when they confront people in power like this, they can be listened to much more clearly because they don't have a chip on their shoulder and they're not pointing at the other person and speaking moralistically. And to become a listener is of immense power when you're an activist. I've seen that over and over. And you become a listener when you're able to listen to yourself at a very deep level.
There's one piece, number 61, in which the master is found after the death of his wife, and he's rejoicing rather than grieving.
It's a marvelous story, yeah.
It's an amazing story. And he gives the person who's talking to him says, "Why are you so happy?" And he gives a speech about the non-existence of her soul, and then its existence, and then its incarnation into her body, and now it's detached again from her body and is lying at peace in a vast room. This is an understanding of reality. It also seems, when I read it, to be a belief from the same guy who told us a little while ago we were supposed to free ourselves from beliefs.
Well, you're a very smart cookie. That's absolutely correct. And that's one of the wonders of stories like this and the verse sections as well. The way I dealt with that, it's a kind of little religion that he's talking about, metaphysics, about I'm not concerned because my wife at some point became a disincarnated being and then incarnated, and then she was born, etc., and it's all part of the flow, and now she's just flowed out of the body again. And this is, you need to understand, this is what the Buddhists call skillful means. Not that he's believing this, he's lying through his teeth, as I see it, because his friend is coming in with outrage, his very conventional friend. This is a philosopher who pops up in a number of these stories and is the voice of the conventional, the pious, and really has his teeth set on edge by Xuanzu's devil-may-care attitude here, because he was known for loving his wife very deeply, and here he is banging a pot and singing at the top of his lungs. But it's really picking a language so that the friend can have some slight grasp of the place where he is, of how unconcerned he is about life and death and about how inappropriate it would be for him to mourn or cry or even, you know, tone down his raucous singing. It's not that these are things that he believes. These are things that his friend can grasp as some way of gaining an insight into this place of freedom that Chuang Tzu is coming from, where life and death are truly trivial matters. Unless you believe something about death, there can't be a problem to it. The friend's attitude is the attitude of most people, not only then but now, and that attitude is, if you don't suffer when somebody else suffers, it means that you don't care, or it means that you don't love them. In other words, if somebody that I love who's in pain, my loving reaction is to suffer from that pain. And that is, one finds out, and anybody who's investigated the mind finds out, that is nonsense.
You say somewhere, and I can't find the page right now, that in the time that these were written, there wasn't even a word for compassion because there wasn't a distinction between self and other. Can you say more about that?
Sure. Compassion is another of these words that the Buddhists might call skillful means. In English, anyway, it comes from to the root where you're feeling with somebody, you're feeling somebody's pain, taking it into yourself and understanding it that way. But when you look more closely, you can see quite easily that it's not possible to feel someone else's pain. That's just a myth. What you feel is your projection of what it must be like to feel the kind of pain that you think the other person is feeling. Compassion, to my mind, is, or what I experience and what I experience from people whose minds are clear and whose hearts are open, is more of an availability, a total availability for somebody who is in pain, whether that pain is physical or mental. And it has nothing to do with sadness. It has nothing to do with pain or suffering. If somebody's in pain, that person is there to help them out if that's what they want, and if they want to wallow in their pain, is there simply to hold their hand or to smile and tell them a bedtime story if that's what they need. But it's the availability that is, I think, the key there. And the other key is that there's no seduction. They're not seduced into pain by the thought that this person should be feeling anything different from what they're feeling. It's a very powerful space of freedom. And when people are suffering, for instance, with my wife, people can be going through the most appalling reliving of events that they've gone through: rape, childhood abuse, schizophrenia, concentration camps, multiple personalities, etc. And since Katie is not opposed to any of that and has opened herself to all of it, she can go in to with them to those places of darkness and not feel one moment of fear or one moment of wishing that it were any different for them. And that helps them get still and really take a close look. And she can take their hand and walk them out of that. It's quite remarkable.
Stephen Mitchell is a scholar and translator. His new book, which we've been talking about, is called The Second Book of the Tao, and he will be speaking tonight at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. Thank you so much for taking all this time with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be talking about the transfer tax in a couple of moments. Please stay tuned to KSFR.